Good morning, Muggles. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. It's 10 minutes past 8 o'clock on this Thursday, July the 19th.
Harry Potter rolled over inside his blankets without waking up. One small hand closed on the letter beside him, and he slept on, not knowing he was special, not knowing he was famous, not knowing he would be woken in a few hours' time by Mrs. Dursley's scream as she opened the front door to put out the milk bottles, nor that he would spend the next few weeks being prodded and pinched by his cousin Dudley. He couldn't know that at this very moment people meeting in secret all over the country were holding up their glasses and saying in hushed voices, "To Harry Potter, the boy who lived."
And this hour we talk about that boy who lived, Harry Potter, and how he has children and adults under his spell. Are you caught up in Harry Potter mania? Are you waiting for the release of the seventh and final book in the series, Harry Potter and the Deathly Hallows? It's released at 12:01 a.m. Saturday, July the 21st. I think I'm one of the few who won't be waiting in line or up all night reading that book. Are you a part of this phenomenon? What is the appeal of Harry Potter? Were you in line for the movie that opened over the weekend, based on the sixth book, if I've got my numbers correct? Fifth book? Oh, gosh, I don't know. Were you? Did you watch the movie? 1-800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234, in Madison, 263-1890, 263-1890. We will welcome in a guest this hour from Lawrence University, who will be teaching a class on the cultural phenomenon of Harry Potter this fall. And we will talk about why this series has been so popular and the effect it's had on our culture. Do you think it's been a positive one or a negative one? There's some controversy over that as well. Join in as we talk, 1-800-642-1234 in Madison, 263-1890, or send an email to talk@wpr.org. Please include your first name and your community with your email. Ed Kern is an associate professor of history at Lawrence University. He'll be teaching a course on Harry Potter and is the author of The Wisdom of Harry Potter, What Our Favorite Hero Teaches Us About Moral Choices. And he joins us by telephone. Good morning.
Good morning.
You're going to teach a course on Harry Potter this fall.
That's correct.
Really? Why?
Well, there's a couple of reasons. You know, this Friday night, I think, marks a sort of major cultural event. Tens of millions of people around the world are going to be lining up to buy a book. And, you know, it's likely that over 20 million copies of that book will be sold in the first 24 hours or so of its release. I think that that's really something. Why a course now? Well, a few weeks back, I was thinking about, actually a few months back, I was thinking about my students and about how many of them had almost quite literally grown up with Harry Potter.
Mm-hmm.
A good number of them were 10 or 11 when they started reading the series, and now when it's reaching its conclusion, they're in their late teens or early 20s. And I thought, this is a teaching opportunity that I just really can't pass up, to give my students the opportunity to apply some of the skills that they've learned in college to a literary and cultural phenomenon of which they've been part in many respects. And so when I sort of put those two things together, I thought to myself, yeah, I think now's the time to teach this course.
Yeah. And you say it's a cultural and literary phenomenon because this is more than just a fad or a popular character.
I think so, yeah. I mean, there's a lot of debate over whether or not the books will have staying power, whether or not the books will be considered one of the classics of children's literature. And in a very real sense, we can't answer that now, but there's been a lot of speculation about it. But beyond that, I think that the books have occasioned, in many respects, the most critically engaged audience of readers in history. I think to a large degree this has been made possible by the existence of the Internet, the World Wide Web, where there are numerous web pages devoted to Harry. There are numerous discussion groups. But regardless, we have hundreds of thousands of people critically engaging the works, speculating about what is going to happen, commenting upon the moral ambiguities in the book, creating fan art or fan fiction. So it really is much more than just a series of books. It's occasioned a whole host of creative and social activities that many of the fans of the books have decided to engage in.
Yeah, and it's not just kids. The adults, too, are in on these 20 million people who are going to read this latest book.
Oh, that's absolutely true. I do think that there's a large adult audience. A large percentage, of course, is a young adult audience. People who began to read the books when they were still children. But there's also a very large percentage of people who I think came to the books because of the children in their lives or because of their interest in fantasy literature or children's literature more broadly. And so a lot of adults are really engaged in the series as well.
So why is this happening? Why is there so much attention, so much Harry Potter mania going on?
Well, some of the critics have pointed to the marketing that has been used, and they say, you know, this marketing, at least in part, explains the success of the books. And I think that's true to some extent. On the other hand, I don't believe that that marketing campaign would work if there wasn't something in the stories themselves that drew readers. If we sort of follow the history, the publication history of the books, we'll see that reader interest really drove the initial stages of the phenomenon. And it was only around the year 2000, 2001, that, the marketing sort of began to catch up with the excitement among readers. And so I really do think that there's something at work in the books themselves. There's a couple of different ways to think about that. First and foremost, they are great adventure stories. Take that away, and we would not be talking about Harry Potter on the radio right now. In other words, I do think that Rowling is a master of narrative and plotting, and her readers just can't get enough of the books because she does those kinds of things so well. They're great adventure stories. Going a little bit beyond that, I think that the books are popular because of the way Rowling writes the book. She uses what, you know, we sometimes call a focalized narrator. In other words, the narrator of the book is not omniscient. Rather, the narrator of the book communicates everything to the reader through the perspective of the protagonist, through Harry's perspective, in other words. And so I think that this writing style, this narrative voice, if you will, really encourages readers to engage in the stories in the way Harry engages in the circumstances in which he finds themselves. And then finally, I think that the books are very popular nowadays because they speak to us. And let me explain what I mean by that. I think many of us nowadays feel that we are, in many respects, the victim of circumstances. We're the victims of forces beyond our control. At the very same time, however, I think that we also like to believe that we're free to chart our own way through these circumstances. We're free to react to these forces beyond our own control in ways that we want to pursue. And once again, Harry as a hero is structured in precisely that way. Half of the time, he's depicted as a victim of circumstance, things he cannot change. The other half of the time, he is depicted as a hero free to choose his own destiny, someone who can work his own pathway through, so to speak, the difficulties that confront him. And nowadays, I believe that many people feel that they find themselves in similar circumstances. They're skeptical of government, they're skeptical of the economic system, they're skeptical of the media and a whole host of other things which seem to be forcing changes upon them that they don't want. At the very same time, very few people are surrendering in the face of those changing circumstances.
Let's talk just a little bit about the story of Harry Potter. As I mentioned, I have not read these books. I've read a lot about them now that preparing for this particular program. But for those who aren't caught up in this phenomenon, this is a story about what?
Well, it's in many respects a very traditional hero's quest. set in a kind of near-contemporary present. In other words, if we take a look at Harry's attributes as a character, he very much resembles the hero of myth, the kind of hero that Joseph Campbell sort of made famous once again a few years back in his book, The Hero with a Thousand Faces. So we can compare Harry to King Arthur, Superman, Jesus of Nazareth, any number of heroic figures. On the other hand, I think that if we take a look at the settings of the Harry Potter stories, they very much resemble the United Kingdom of the 1990s, which, you know, in many respects resembles pretty much every other part of the Western world as well. And so what Rowling has done is taken this very sort of traditional hero's quest and updated it for a contemporary audience by placing Harry in circumstances that are not so unfamiliar from our own circumstances, despite, of course, the fantastic, magical settings and practices that we get to witness within the books.
Yeah, I was even getting a little more specific than that, in that I played a clip in the very beginning about the boy who lived.
Right.
There was the evil villain killed Harry's parents.
That's correct. Right.
Yeah, and this evil villain has been going through all of these books, posing problems for Harry, right?
That's right. Mm-hmm. That's exactly it. Mm-hmm. You know, Harry begins life almost, at least on the pages of the books, as an orphan. His nemesis, Lord Voldemort, has, killed his parents, and at least early on, we don't know why this is the case. And we also know that Lord Voldemort killed Harry's parents during his attempt to kill the infant Harry when he was only 1 year old. And, the reasons for this gradually become clear as the series progresses. But in several of the books, Harry has to confront his nemesis in a number of different settings, including the first book and the second book and the fourth book. But in other books, other events involving Harry's nemesis sort of draw Harry into dangerous circumstances, mm-hmm. in which he has to sort of make the right decisions in order to get things to turn out okay. He, of course, is placed initially with his aunt and uncle, Vernon, and Petunia Dursley, who are just horrible, almost as horrible as their son, Dudley Dursley, who turned the first 10 years of Harry's life into a kind of, living hell in many respects. Upon Harry's 10th birthday, Harry learns that he is, in fact, a wizard, and that during the academic year, he will be able to go off to Hogwarts Academy of Witchcraft and Wizardry. And, of course, this school, Hogwarts, becomes a kind of escape for Harry from the misery that sort of typified the first 10 years of his upbringing. And so each subsequent book in the series begins, in a sense, with the Dursleys and then moves Harry and the action to Hogwarts Academy of Witchcraft and Wizardry, along with a couple of other settings as well.
Yeah.
And there Harry has to confront whatever sort of mystery or problem is, is at work during that particular academic year.
And in this world, you have magical powers, or you're a muggle.
That's correct. That's right. A relatively small percentage of the human population have magical powers, and they tend to be inborn abilities. You have to learn how to use and control magic, but in a very real sense, you either have it or you don't.
Yeah. Well, I didn't know that, but Muggles, you can join in with your thoughts about Harry Potter. Are you a part of this Harry Potter mania? What is the appeal of Harry Potter? What questions do you have about Harry Potter as a cultural and literary phenomenon? 1-800-642-1234. Help me understand. 1-800-642-1234. In Madison, 263-1890. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network. This is the Ideas Network. I'm Joy Cardine. Hope you stay tuned. John Munson in for Ben Marins this afternoon between 4 and 6. And John, after 5 o'clock, we'll be talking with the author of The History of Whaling in America. It's coming up after 5. We're talking about Harry Potter, with our guest, Ed Kern, Associate Professor of History at Lawrence University. He's the author of the book, The Wisdom of Harry Potter, What Our Favorite Hero Teaches Us About Moral Choices. And he's also going to be teaching a class on the cultural phenomenon of Harry Potter this fall. Talking with him on this day before the release of the last book in the mega-popular Harry Potter series. It is released at midnight tomorrow. And we're wondering what thoughts and questions you have about Harry Potter mania, wondering if you or your kids are a part of all this. 1-800-642-1234 in Madison, 263-1890. Kathy in Watertown is with us first. Hi, Kathy. You're on the air.
Hi. Good morning. I my son is a fan, and he has this week read the first six books over again, probably for the fourth time, in preparation of the seventh book coming out. And he just, I think he's finished with them.
So. Did you say this week he read all six?
Oh, indeed. He is, he's a reader, and yes.
Yeah, is he going to be a big staying up all night tonight reading number seven? Or, I mean, tomorrow night?
I think he will read it probably in the morning. It depends on his work schedule. He's a high school student. But mm-hmm. He's been there since the beginning, and it's turned into topics of conversation at the table, the movies, and et cetera. So, and now his younger sister is getting into him a little bit, so...
And did you read them too, Kathy?
I have not started them. I haven't had time.
Yeah, I know that my sisters and her family, both my niece and nephew, have read all of the books, and the mom and dad read them as well. It was a real family affair. Ed Kern, that's pretty typical, isn't it?
It really is. I think Kathy's son is doing the kind of thing that, certainly hundreds of thousands, if not millions of kids worldwide are doing right now, working through the books in preparation for the release. And he's of a generation that, I have in mind in presenting my course thinking about Harry Potter next fall. This is the generation of kids who, as I said earlier, almost quite literally grew up with Harry. Your observation is also very typical. I think that the Harry Potter books have occasioned a lot of family activities as parents read them to their children or as parents read the books upon the recommendation of their children. So it's really not an uncommon experience at all.
It is credited for getting a lot of kids interested in reading again, or maybe reading more than they had been reading. But there was some critics of Harry Potter thinking that it was, anti-Christian, was promoting witchcraft?
That's true, yeah. Recently, whether or not Harry Potter has encouraged reading throughout the younger generation beyond the Harry Potter books themselves has come under question, and I'd be happy to return to that if you're interested in it. But yes, at least early on in the late 90s and early during this decade, a number of authors began to launch attacks against the Harry Potter books, seeing them as contrary to Christianity. And they usually point to a passage in Deuteronomy that denounces what we might call magic or witchcraft or sorcery today. And they say, see the similarities between the kinds of things Harry is doing in this passage in Deuteronomy. What they fail to realize, at least from my perspective, as well as the perspective of others who have defended the books from a Christian perspective, is that the Harry Potter books present magic and witchcraft as fantasy. In other words, there's no implication that this kind of thing is real. It's a fantasy world. And so the denunciation of it that one finds in a relatively limited number of biblical passages really don't apply to it. It's not the kind of magic that the authors of the biblical books had in mind, or so the argument goes. At the very least, I think that the witchcraft and magic in history draws from historical, legendary, and mythological precedents. But there's absolutely, as I said earlier, no implication that there's anything demonic about this. Harry's nemesis is a kind of satanic figure insofar as he is evil, but his evil is his own. He's not drawing sustenance and support and power from a kind of supernatural evil being equivalent to the Christian devil.
Let me play one of the clips that might illustrate what you're talking about.
Don't you turn your back on me, Harry Potter! I want you to look at me when I kill you! I want to see the light leave your eyes!
Have it your way.
Well, that was from Book 4, Goblet of Fire, and that was Harry and Voldemort casting spells on each other?
That's correct, mm-hmm. Yeah. Harry finds himself magically transported to a graveyard where Lord Voldemort is going to reconstitute himself into a corporeal human form. Before that, he's been much diminished, and it becomes an almost quasi-spiritual or quasi-ghost-like figure for reasons that we only learn later on in the series. But yes, Harry is locked in a duel with Lord Voldemort at that point, and Voldemort is trying to kill Harry. Harry is defending himself as best he can.
Floyd in Marquette, Michigan is with us now. Hi, you're on the air.
Morning. I'm a 57-year-old college prof, and I love these books. And one of the ways that I've enjoyed them perhaps more than anything else is in the audio form, recorded by Jim Dale. He's a British actor who lives in America. And this amazing performer has come up with apparently 200 voice characterizations for each of the characters who speak in this series. And it's an incredible experience. And then to listen to the book, I've found, puts almost a cinematic thing in your head in a way that when you read, at least when I read too fast, and I just don't always catch everything. And when I hear it read, and I sense it, and I kind of imagine it in my head, it's just an amazing experience. I understand that there's a different actor, Bloomsbury, the British publisher, hired a different actor to read in the British recorded books version. And I don't know, does your guest have any response to that, or have you heard either the British or the American recorded books, and what kind of responses do you have to that?
Yeah, I've heard bits and pieces of both actors. The British actor, the actor who reads the British editions of the books is Stephen Fry, and both he and Jim Dale do a fantastic job. I've not listened to the books in their entirety. Just the other day, I read an interview with Jim Dale, and I believe that there's 120 hours of him reading the books so far, so that anyone who wants to sit down and listen to the audio versions of the books should set some time aside, because it's going to take more than a few days to get through them all. I also agree with you about experiencing the books in that audio format. Certainly reading the books is an enjoyable experience, but listening to them is, in fact, a different kind of experience. I agree with you. And it does conjure up images in one's mind that might not otherwise be available if you're just reading through them very quickly, as you suggested.
Well, let's listen to Jim Dale and other voices in this clip of the audio book, Half-Blood Prince, Book 6 in the series.
Snape gazed for a moment at Dumbledore, and there was revulsion and hatred etched in the harsh lines of his face.
Severus, please.
Snape raised his wand and pointed it directly at Dumbledore.
Avada Kedavra!
A jet of green light shot from the end of Snape's wand and hit Dumbledore squarely in the chest. Harry's scream of horror never left him. Silent and unmoving, he was forced to watch as Dumbledore was blasted into the air. For a split second, he seemed to hang suspended beneath the shining skull. And then he fell slowly backward, like a great rag doll, over the battlements and out of sight.
Well, that's pretty tragic. Dumbledore was killed.
Absolutely. Harry has lost all of his father figures and mentors. I think one more, Rubius Hagrid, is probably going to emerge as a mentor in the seventh book. Dumbledore's death, I think, is one of the more significant episodes in the books. And at least initially, following the release of Harry Potter and the Half-Blood Prince, there was a lot of speculation among fans that Dumbledore wasn't really dead. In other words, people, I think, were afraid to see Harry's mentor get lost. But I think it's important to realize that the old guy with the beard almost always dies as a hero goes into the final stages of his quest. And in fact, J.K. Rowling confirmed that last summer in response to a question from Salman Rushdie, of all people, at a reading that she did in New York City, in which she said that, no, Dumbledore is in fact dead, although we might be seeing him in some sense in the seventh book.
The seventh book also will see, we hear anyway, that some other character or characters die.
That's correct, yeah. You know, I think that J.K. Rowling throughout the series has asked her young readers to really deal with a lot, not the least of which is the death of some significant characters. Early on, some characters die along the way. Some of them are quite likable, some of them are not. But since the fifth book, a major character has been killed in the climax of each one. And she's promising at least two other, the demise of at least two other major characters in this final book.
Alex in Milwaukee is with us now. Hi, Alex.
Hello, Joy. Hello to the guest. Very entertaining show. I have a bold prediction. I have not. I have no inside information about the seventh book, but I think if Rowling's adheres to true literary tragedy, I think Harry Potter has to die then, and maybe by sacrificing himself, he will win in the final analysis. Much like Conan Doyle had to kill off Sherlock Holmes in order to win over Moriarty. But eventually, Conan Doyle had to bring back Sherlock Holmes, and probably there'll be an eighth book, Harry Potter and the Cauldron of Cash. I wish I would have made that up. I didn't. But can the guest comment on that and the parallel between Holmes, Moriarty, and Harry Potter and Lord Voldemort? And I'll listen on the radio. Bye-bye.
Well, that's an excellent set of questions. I do think that from a purely literary perspective, Harry's sacrificial death would be appropriate. In other words, I do think that that would be an appropriate ending following from the parameters of the story established early on. I think that the notion of love, and in particular sacrificial love, have been key features of the Harry Potter stories. However, for what I might call extra literary reasons, I don't think that will happen. I just don't think that Rowling is going to kill off Harry in a literal sense. These are children's books, after all, and I do think that many readers would be crushed by that news, especially because, as I was mentioning earlier, the narrative voice of the books really encourages readers to identify with Harry. Mm. However, I do agree with the guest in one very important respect. Harry will have to embrace death in some way. How literal or how metaphorical that is, I don't know. But he will have to embrace death. And the reason for that is simple. His nemesis, Lord Voldemort, has chosen to reject the ultimate reality of death. In fact, in French, Voldemort means flight from death or theft of death. And so he has been constructed as a character who refuses to die. It is what he most fears. And so I think Harry, in the last battle, so to speak, will embrace death and, in essence, tell Voldemort, I am not afraid of this. You are, and that is what makes you weak. And so I do think that we will see Harry, as I said a couple of times now, embrace death. Precisely how that takes shape, I don't know yet. The parallels to Arthur Conan Doyle and his character Sherlock Holmes are also very telling. Rowling clearly, I think, would like in many respects to be rid of Harry. You know, as fun as this ride has been for her, I think that it's also, you know, produced a lot of anxiety. She entered into a period of writer's block immediately following her $100,000 advance from Scholastic, so she had trouble finishing the second book because of that. So I think the temptation is there to kill off Harry, but I really don't think that she will do so for the same reasons that Arthur Conan Doyle wanted to kill off Sherlock Holmes. Just on a personal note, I really hope that Rowling sticks to her original plan and keeps Harry's adventures limited to 7 books. I think so often when authors or artists return to a project that they completed or thought they had completed, what follows from it is never as good as the original. And J.K. Rowling planned this series as a series of 7 books, and there's a very tight narrative arc that begins in book 1 and which will conclude in book 7. And so I hope she doesn't return and bring back Harry for additional adventures at Hogwarts or elsewhere in the magical world.
We're talking about Harry Potter and how tomorrow night, muggles and wizards alike will be celebrating the release of the 7th and final book in the Harry Potter series. We are talking with Ed Kern, an associate professor of history at Lawrence University, who will be teaching a course on Harry Potter this fall, the cultural phenomenon of Harry Potter. He's also the author of The Wisdom of Harry Potter, What Our Favorite Hero Teaches Us About Moral Choices. And we are talking about Harry Potter mania. 1-800-642-1234 in Madison, 263-1890. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network. You're listening to the Ideas Network. I'm Joy Cardine. Coming up after 9 o'clock, a recent national intelligence estimate says Al-Qaeda has reorganized to pre-9/11 strength, regrouping in Pakistan near the Afghan border. After 9, Kathleen and her guests will discuss the role of Pakistan in combating the Al-Qaeda threat. That's coming up after 9. Back to the phones now, talking about Harry Potter mania. Amy in Appleton has been waiting. Hi, Amy. You're on the air.
Hi, Joy. Thanks for taking my call. I'm actually, my comment reverts back to when we were discussing about the families reading Harry together.
Mm-hmm.
My son and I actually just 30 minutes ago were talking about tomorrow night's party because that tradition between the two of us of going to those parties and always reading the first chapter before we go to sleep started just before third grade, and now he's 14. And he actually is passing up going with a bunch of his friends because the tradition of us doing this together and reading these books together has been actually a really wonderful thing for me. I hope it's a wonderful thing for him. But it's interesting when you were talking before about families not reading these books together. The moral issues that your guest has brought up are very important. But I think just having a tradition with your children based in something like this, and when you're just reading something and using your minds together, it's absolutely priceless. So I'm really looking forward to tomorrow night. And I have two other sons who absolutely have not had any interest in Harry Potter at all, two younger sons than this one.
Is that right?
But I'm hoping they I have three children who are very individualistic, and I don't know if the fact that my oldest and I have been very Harry Potter enthralled for some time. We're still waiting to see the other two. The middle one is an Artemis Fowl fan. So we do have that, but unfortunately they don't have the kinds of parties and fervor around the Artemis Fowl books that Harry Potter does.
No, where's the party? At a bookstore or someone's house?
Conkey's bookstore. I'm sure that Professor Kearns knows that one.
Oh, sure. Absolutely.
So, yeah, we run into people in the neighborhood and whatnot. What's powerful for me as well as far as tradition goes is my father is British. I was raised in England for 3 years, and actually we didn't have a TV for most of that time. So my father used to read C.S. Lewis books to us and E. Nesbitt. And so this has really allowed me to bring some of my childhood to my children. And I do read to my other kids. They don't have the attachment to a character like my oldest son does to Harry. Right.
Well, have fun at the party, Amy. It sounds like it's been a good tradition. Is your son, by the way, are you both dreading the end of this series or what?
Well, actually, we were talking about, we had heard that there's at least two characters that are probably going to die in this one. And I personally feel that there's not a way for J.K. Rowling to kill Harry. I think that Harry has made these incredible sacrifices against evil by losing his parents, losing Dumbledore. And my son and I actually think Hagrid's probably going to get it this time.
I agree with that.
You do?
I do.
Yeah.
And I think it's going to be either Ron or Hermione is the other one. But this is what's amazing is seeing this boy. We read the first book when he was in first grade. We didn't go to the first round of parties. It wasn't until third grade that we started doing that. But I have seen him almost grow up like Harry has through these books. And maybe that's a little, you know, through the eyes of a mom. But he's very emotionally attached to these characters. But he also can have these conversations about, you know, making good choices in the context of Harry. Unfortunately, you know, sometimes you don't get the real life conversation with them that you want. But certainly through these characters, I'm really impressed at what it's lent to expanding his mind and capabilities.
Yeah. Professor Kearns.
I agree in particular with the last observation. I think that there is a sort of moral core that runs throughout each of these books that encourage child readers to think very carefully about issues such as responsibility, issues such as right and wrong, issues about moral ambiguity and how you need to put moral principles to work in particular circumstances rather than simply following a set of rules. You know, Harry and his friends break the rules a lot, sometimes with not so good reasons, sometimes with very good reasons. And in my discussions with child readers of the books as well as children's librarians, they nearly almost always begin talking about Harry's adventures and the freedom that they imply and the excitement that they imply. But they also tend to circle back to moral issues about how Harry and his friends really do try to do the right thing in difficult circumstances.
Yeah, and I'm sorry, what was the character that you think is going to be murdered or killed off?
Rubeus Hagrid, who was Keeper of the Keys and Gamekeeper of Hogwarts. He then became Professor of Magical Creatures. And he has been a kind of mentor to Harry throughout the series, and I think that he is the last of Harry's mentors. And so he will probably meet his demise in this final book.
Yeah, Amy thought that maybe Hermione, Harry's friend, girlfriend, was going to maybe go?
Right. That's a lot of people have speculated. Hermione is not Harry's girlfriend. She is one of his...
She's
his
a friend who's a girl.
Two best friends, mm-hmm. Right, exactly. Many people have speculated that either she or Ron, one or the other, Ron is Harry's other best friend, that one of the two might have to die. I don't think so. I just don't think that Rowling will kill off any more child characters. My vote for the other likely character to meet his demise is Severus Snape, the potions master who murdered Dumbledore at the end of Book 6. I think that no other character is sort of as over-determined for redemption as Severus Snape, and I think that he will probably die a heroic death in Harry's service in the last book.
Wendy in Manitowoc is with us now. Hi, Wendy.
Hi. I was wondering, I listened from the beginning of the program, and Professor Kern was talking about whether or not the Harry Potter franchise, if you will, or whatever, would become a classic in children's literature. Now, I started reading the books because my nephews had started reading them and were talking about them, and at that time it had become this, you know, huge thing in the media from the very beginning, how kids were reading again, and my children were too young at that time. So I said, I'm going to read these books. I'm curious. And I started, and I got hooked on the first one, and that was it. I was done. I said, I've got to read them all now. And my children now are getting hooked on them through me. And I'm 42. And I just wonder if anybody's really thought about that, how, you know, the parent, you've mentioned how adults are also hooked on these books, that, you know, we're carrying it on through generations now by starting the younger ones on it also. And, you know, I don't know. I'm thinking that it will become a classic, maybe just for that reason.
I think that that's quite possible. You know, generational growth is one of the key themes, if you will, of the Harry Potter books. One of the more interesting things about the book is that the further Harry travels into the future with each subsequent book, the further he travels into the past by learning the history of his parents and his family. And so I do think that those generational connections or familial connections are also being experienced by readers of the books. Whether the books will be classics, in a sense, only time will tell. There's a couple of good indicators, however. Numerous critics of the books, critics who both dislike the books and or like the books, disagree among one another about what the books are about. And that's always a good sign that there's a lot more taking place in the book than at first meets the eye. If you can find two critics who are diametrically opposed in their interpretation of a particular work of literature, that's an excellent indication that there's a lot more happening beneath the surface. Some of the critics who have attacked the Harry Potter books and criticized them for being bland or formulaic or conventional or conservative, I think make a basic mistake in their approach to the books. Rowling writes in a relatively simple prose style, and I think they confuse simplicity with badness. In other words, they see simple prose as being bad prose, and I just disagree vehemently with that. Rowling has chosen dialogue, action, and telling detail in order to prompt the imagination of her readers, rather than weighty description. And so we don't find a lot of description at work in the books, which I think a lot of critics like to see. They point to the beauty of the language, and when they do that kind of thing with Rowling, they just see a kind of simplicity of style that doesn't appeal to them. But Rowling is a pure genius when it comes to issues such as plot in narrative structure. And I think that the success of her books shows that readers really do enjoy complicated stories when they are well told. The pacing of the books is very good, even the longer ones. Some people have accused them of being a little bit flabby, as it were. But even there, I think they're off the mark. And then also, I think that there's a real moral core, as I alluded to earlier in the books, that will appeal to subsequent generations of readers as well.
Let's listen to another clip from the audiobook, Order of the Phoenix, which is book number 5 in the series. This is Harry and friends fighting in the Ministry of Magic to retrieve a prophecy in a glass ball about him and Voldemort.
When Sybil Trelawney spoke, it was not in her usual ethereal, mystic voice, but in the harsh, hoarse tones Harry had heard her use once before. "The one with the power to vanquish the Dark Lord approaches, born to those who have thrice defied him, born as the seventh month dies, and the Dark Lord will mark him as his equal. But he will have power the Dark Lord knows not, and either must die at the hand of the other, for neither can live while the other survives. The one with the power to vanquish the Dark Lord will be born as the seventh month dies."
And before having you respond, Professor Kern, Mary in Waukesha sent us an email that says, "It seems to me that everyone is forgetting the prophecy from Order of the Phoenix that said one must die so that the other can live. There were two boys born at the same time to whom the prophecy could apply. One was Harry, and the other was Neville Longbottom. It could be interpreted that Neville must die in order for Harry to live, or it could be that Neville is the one that, through some plot twist or another, that ultimately brings down Lord Voldemort." It goes on, but you want to respond?
I think that that is a distinct possibility. We have Professor Dumbledore's word for it that the prophecy applies to Harry. But, you know, Dumbledore has been wrong before. And so there's a possibility that, you know, Neville may play a key role in bringing down Lord Voldemort. At the end of the last book, Professor Dumbledore tells Harry that he could basically ignore the prophecy, that prophecies in and of themselves really have no real power. Instead, it's how people choose to react to such prophecies. And so what initiates the great battle, so to speak, between Lord Voldemort and Harry is Lord Voldemort's decision to see Harry as his nemesis, and thus he marks him as his enemy. But Dumbledore tells Harry that Harry is free to turn away from the prophecy. It's possible that Dumbledore, of course, is wrong.
Yeah. Marty? In Spring Prairie. Hi, you're on the air.
Hi. For me, one of the moral teachings of the book is exhibited by the fact that Lord Voldemort puts all the negative experiences of his life into Harry. He forces him to experience all the loss that he had.
Mm-hmm. I agree. There's clearly some connection, which, you know, to date has not yet been fully explained, between Voldemort and Harry. And Harry has certainly gained some of the power as well as some of the feelings and emotions of Voldemort. In fact, periodically throughout the series, Harry comes to doubt his own self-worth because he recognizes some of Voldemort's own motives and tendencies within himself.
So are you going to Conkey's tomorrow for the party, the Harry Potter party,
well,
Professor Quinn?
I have in the past, but actually I'm participating in the activities that the Appleton Barnes & Noble store have put together for tomorrow night. So, yes, I will be at a party, but not the one at Conkey's.
Yeah, will you be reading this thing all night long, as I hear many people will be doing?
You know, I don't know if I'm going to do that or not. I think I'm going to come home and start reading, and if in an hour's time going to bed sounds good, that's probably what I'll do. If making a pot of coffee and staying up the rest of the night sounds good, I might do that as well.
Well, we will maybe talk again about the lasting effect of Harry Potter. Thanks a lot for being with us.
I'd be happy to do that, and thanks for having me.
Ed Kern, Associate Professor of History at Lawrence University. He's going to be teaching a course on Harry Potter this fall, the cultural phenomenon of Harry Potter. He's also the author of The Wisdom of Harry Potter, What Our Favorite Hero Teaches Us About Moral Choices. Talking to us because Harry Potter mania is in full swing with the release of the seventh and final book of the Harry Potter series set for tomorrow night at midnight. Thanks to Leo Duran for producing the hour, and thanks for lots of help from John Munson and Strange Champs, Jim Fleming, and Steve Berg. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network.